to the New York Stock Exchange trading floor, I found people hijacked by stress. Unable to predict where the financial tsunami would head next, they were straitjacketed by despair and incapable of moving forward. I didn't fully understand what was keeping them so frozen in inaction until a manager told me point blank, "Market forces are out of my control. Share prices are out of my control. My boss's decisions are out of my control. So there's nothing I can do. The waters feel like they're getting higher each day." What I've realized from many companies I've spoken with over the past 2 years is that the meltdown of 2008 and its aftershocks had instilled a form of learned helplessness, a belief in the futility of our actions, in many of the world's workers. But the problem is, when we eliminate any upward options from our mental maps, and worse, eliminate our motivation to search for them, we end up undermining our ability to tackle the challenge at hand. And it doesn't end there. When people feel helpless in one area of life, they not only give up in that one area, they often overlearn the lesson and apply it to other situations. They become convinced that one dead-end path must be proof that all possible paths are dead ends. A setback at work might lead to despondency about one's relationship, or a rift with a friend might discourage us from trying to form bonds with our colleagues, and so on. When this happens, our helplessness spirals out of control, impeding our success in all areas of life. It's the very definition of pessimism and depression. An event map with all dead ends, and a surefire route to failure. We don't have to stretch far to see this negative cycle on a larger social scale. Learned helplessness is endemic in inner city schools, prisons, and elsewhere. When people don't believe there is a way up, they have virtually no choice but to stay as down as they are. Finding the path up. You've probably heard the oft-told story of the two shoe salesmen who were sent to Africa in the early 1900s to assess opportunities. They wired separate telegrams back to their boss. One read, "Situation hopeless. They don't wear shoes." The other read, "Glorious opportunity. They don't have any shoes yet." Odds are the same two salesmen would send back similar emails today if they were sent to Alaska to sell air conditioners or to the Gobi Desert to sell swimsuits. The point, of course, is that when some people meet adversity, they simply stop looking for ways to turn failures into opportunities, or negatives into positives. Others, the most successful among us, know that it's not the adversity itself, but what we do with it that determines our fate. Some will sit helpless, while others gather their wits, capitalize on their strengths, and forge ahead. A Tale of Two Brokers. Imagine two stockbrokers. For simplicity, we'll call them Ben and Paul. Both are making high six-figure salaries, plus bonuses. Both have been in their positions for many years and expect to be in them for many years more. And then comes the financial tsunami that sweeps them both away. Paul is devastated. His way of life is at stake, as is a special order Mercedes. And every day brings worse news, a running invitation to sink deeper in despair. Ben, while initially just as upset, chooses to see the event as an opportunity to reevaluate his goals and pursue a new project. Similar backgrounds, almost identical professional experiences, very different outcomes. We all know people who have reacted to adversity like Paul, but Ben's story is just as real. Ben Axler was an associate director in the investment banking division at Barclays when he was unexpectedly laid off. Instead of feeling sorry for himself, he decided that there was no time like the present to make the career move he'd been dreaming of, and he started a hedge fund. In short, Ben capitalized on his bad luck by turning it into an opportunity, and the opportunity turned out to be a good one. Despite the down economy, he was able to sign up a whole new slew of clients and ended up both happier and better off financially than when he started, all because he was able to find the third path. Crisis as catalyst. Fortunately, just as personal crises can provide the foundation for positive individual growth, so can economic ones. They often propel companies to greater success, and many business juggernauts of the 20th century, Hewlett-Packard, and Texas Instruments among them, were actually launched during the Great Depression. Similarly, America's top companies have often used recessions to reevaluate and improve their business practices. As Time pointed out way back in 1958, though its message is just as relevant today, for every company that slims down its operation, another discovers new ways of doing things that should have been in effect for years, but were overlooked during the boom. Economic adversity forces companies to find creative ways to cut costs and inspires managers to get back in touch with the employees and operations on the ground floor. One company president admitted that going through a recession had actually proved invaluable. "We found all sorts of revisions we could make to improve our operation. Now these revisions work so well, we wouldn't go back to the old way of doing things even if the recession ended tomorrow." This may have been written over 50 years ago, but one look at how the most successful companies have pulled themselves up from the recent recession tells us that it holds just as true today. The best leaders are the ones who show their true colors not during the banner years, but during such times of struggle. While leaders' natural reaction to financial crisis may be to lay low and wait for things to pick up, the Wall Street Journal stresses that this is exactly the wrong approach. Instead, managers should redouble their efforts because crises can be catalysts for creativity. Leaders who become paralyzed by the obstacles in front of them miss this great opportunity. Helplessness will drive down not just their own performance, but also employee well-being and their company's bottom line. On the other hand, leaders who find themselves energized by challenge and motivated by failure reap all kinds of amazing rewards. For example, when other leaders were struggling just to keep their companies afloat, Indra Nooyi, the CEO of PepsiCo, saw the recession as an opportunity to travel around the globe, boosting the spirits and trust of her employees in person. And this paid dividends. Not only did she strengthen the overall morale and performance of her company, but in 2009, Fortune voted her the most powerful woman in business. The point is that when faced with obstacles or failure, succumbing to helplessness keeps us down on the mat, while looking for the path of opportunity helps us pick ourselves up. With this in mind, here are a few strategies for finding that third path in our careers and professional lives. Change your counterfact. Consider the following scenario I've presented to business leaders in countries around the globe, always to the same effect. Imagine for a moment that you walk into a bank. There are 50 other people in the bank. A robber walks in and fires his weapon once. You are shot in the right arm. Now, if you were honestly describing this event to your friends and coworkers the next day, do you describe it as lucky or unlucky? When I pose the same question to executives in my training sessions, the response is generally and vociferously divided about 70-30. 70% claim it is a supremely unfortunate event. The other 30% claim to have been very unfortunate indeed. It's telling enough that the same event could inspire such different interpretations, but the real insight comes when I ask them to explain how they came to their decisions. People who are in the unfortunate group say something like the following: "I could have walked into any bank at any time. This kind of thing almost never happens. How unlucky is it that I happened to be there and that I was shot? There's a bullet in my arm. That's objectively unfortunate. I entered the bank perfectly healthy and I left in an ambulance. I don't know about you, Sean, but that's not my idea of a good time." One of my favorite responses came from a banker named Elsie with an impeccable British accent. "This is fundamentally inconvenient," she said dryly. But my all-time favorite response, which I've actually heard more than once and always from someone on Wall Street: "There were at least 50 other people in the bank. Surely someone deserved getting shot more than I did." With a response like that, I'm not sure that's true. These people cannot understand how a typical bank errand turned gunshot wound could be construed as fortunate. But then they hear the other side's explanation of the same event. "I could have been shot somewhere far worse than my arm. I could have died. I feel incredibly fortunate. It's amazing that nobody else got hurt. There were at least 50 other people in the bank, including children. It's unbelievably lucky that everybody lived to tell the tale." even though the responses differ dramatically, the point is that every brain in the room does the exact same thing. It invents. And that's an important word. A counterfact. A counterfact is an alternate scenario our brains create to help us to evaluate and make sense of what really happened. Here's what I mean. The people who saw the outcome as unlucky imagined an alternate scenario of not having been shot at all. In comparison, their outcome seems very unfortunate. But the other group invented a very different alternate scenario, that they could have been shot in the head and died, or that many other people could have been hurt. Compared with that, surviving is very fortunate. Here's the crucial part. Both the counterfacts are completely hypothetical. Because it's invented, we actually have the power in any given situation to consciously select a counterfact that makes us feel fortunate rather than helpless. And choosing a positive counterfact, besides simply making us feel better, sets ourselves up for the whole host of benefits to motivation and performance we now know accompanies a positive mindset. On the other hand, choosing a counterfact that makes us more fearful of the adversity actually makes it loom larger than it really is. For example, in one interesting study, researchers at the University of Virginia asked participants to stand on a skateboard at the top of a hill and estimate the slope of the hill below them. The more frightened and uncomfortable the subject was standing on the skateboard, the higher and steeper the slope appeared. When we choose a counterfact that makes us feel worse, we are actually altering our reality, allowing the obstacle to exert far greater influence over us than it otherwise should. Change your explanatory style. Most professionals face daily setbacks, but the life of a salesman is, almost by definition, fraught with failure and rejection. In many businesses, only 1 in 10 pitches leads to a sale, meaning that those salesmen experience rejection 90% of the time. This can get pretty demoralizing after a while, which helps to explain why there is such a high turnover among life insurance salesmen. In the late 1980s, the turnover had gotten so bad at MetLife that half the new salesmen were quitting in year one, and only 1 in 5 remained by the fourth year. All told, the company was losing over $75 million a year in hiring costs alone. That's when MetLife hired Martin Seligman, who by then had moved on from studying learned helplessness in dogs, and was now using these findings to explore how people bounce back from all kinds of adversity. Seligman had noticed that while most research subjects would indeed start to feel distressed and helpless after facing setback after setback, a consistent minority seemed immune. No matter what difficulty they faced, they always bounced right back. He soon discovered that they all shared a positive way of interpreting adversity, or what the researchers termed an optimistic explanatory style. Decades of subsequent study have since shown that explanatory style, how we choose to explain the nature of past events, has a crucial impact on our happiness and future success. People with an optimistic explanatory style interpret adversity as being local and temporary. That is, it's not that bad, and it will get better. While those with a pessimistic explanatory style see these events as more global and permanent. That is, it's really bad, and it's never going to change. Their beliefs then directly affect their actions. The ones who believe the latter statement sink into helplessness and stop trying, while the ones who believe the former are spurred on to higher performance. Virtually all avenues of success we now know are dictated by explanatory style. It predicts how well students do in high school, and even how well new recruits do at the U.S. Military Academy. First-year plebes with a more optimistic explanatory style perform better than test scores predict, and are less likely to drop out than their peers. In the world of sports, studies of athletes ranging from collegiate swimmers to professional baseball players show that explanatory style predicts athletic performance. It even predicts how well people recover after coronary bypass surgery. So when Seligman was brought on to help solve the problems the salespeople were having at MetLife, one of the first things he looked at was their explanatory style. And indeed, testing revealed that the agents with more optimistic styles sold 37% more insurance than those with pessimistic ones, and that the most optimistic agents actually sold fully 88% more than the most pessimistic ones. Furthermore, agents who were more optimistic were half as likely to quit as were the pessimists. This was the answer MetLife was looking for. They decided to hire a special force of agents picked solely on the basis of explanatory style, and it paid off. The next year, these agents outsold their more pessimistic counterparts by 21%, during the second year, by 57%. Aware it had struck gold, MetLife decided to completely overhaul its hiring practices from that day on. If would-be agents failed the regular industry tests, but scored well in an evaluation of explanatory style, MetLife hired them anyway. And if they passed the industry test, but had a low score on explanatory style, the company rejected them, no matter how smart they seemed. The results? Within only a few years, MetLife's turnover had plummeted, while its market share had increased by almost 50%. Learn your ABCDs. Of course, turning adversity into opportunity is a skill that comes more naturally to some than others. Some people already have an optimistic explanatory style. They automatically imagine alternative scenarios that make them feel fortunate, interpret setbacks as short-lived and small in scope, and see inherent opportunity where others see only foreboding. Others don't have an optimistic explanatory style. Luckily, these techniques can be learned. One way to help ourselves see the path from adversity to opportunity is to practice the ABCD model of interpretation. Adversity, belief, consequence, and disputation. Adversity is the event we can't change. It is what it is. Belief is our reaction to the event, why we thought it happened, and what we think it means for the future. Is it a problem that is only temporary and local in nature, or do we think it is permanent and pervasive? Are there ready solutions, or do we think it is unsolvable? If we believe the former, that is, if we see the adversity as short-term or as an opportunity for growth, or appropriately confined to only part of our life, then we maximize the chance of a positive consequence. But if the belief has led us down a more pessimistic path, helplessness and inaction can bring negative consequences. That's when it's time to put the D to work. Disputation involves first telling ourselves that our belief is just that, a belief, not fact, and then challenging or disputing it. Psychologists recommend that we externalize this voice, that is, pretend it's coming from someone else. So it's like we're actually arguing with another person. What is the evidence for this belief? Is it airtight? Would we let a friend get away with such reasoning? Or is the reasoning clearly specious once we step outside of ourselves and take a look? What are some other plausible interpretations of this event? What are some more adaptive reactions to it? Is there another counterfactual we can adopt instead? And finally, if the adversity truly is bad, is it as bad as we first thought? This particular method is called decatastrophizing, taking time to show ourselves that while adversity is real, it is perhaps not as catastrophic as we may have made it out to be. That may seem like a positive platitude stripped off of a Hallmark card, but the idea that things are never as bad as they seem is actually a fact based upon our fundamental biology. Because thousands of years of evolution have made us so remarkably good at adapting to even the most extreme life circumstances, adversity never hits us quite as hard, or for quite as long, as we might think. For example, we might assume that a horrible injury would forever alter our ability to be happy. But in fact, after initial adjustment and period of hardship, most victims of paralysis bounce back to just about the same level of happiness they experienced before. Simply speaking, the human psyche is so much more resilient than we even realize, which is why when faced with a terrible prospect, for example, the end of a love affair or of a job, we overestimate how unhappy it will make us, and for how long. We fall victim to immune neglect, which means we consistently forget how good our psychological immune system is at helping us to get over adversity. Daniel Gilbert, author of Stumbling on Happiness, has performed a number of studies showing immune neglect in action. College students overestimate how devastated they would feel at the end of a romantic relationship. Assistant professors predict that being denied tenure would lead to drastically lower levels of happiness, when in fact, professors denied tenure do not experience this at all. Adversities, no matter what they are, simply don't hit us as hard as we think they will. Just knowing this quirk of human psychology, that our fear of consequences is always worse than the consequences themselves, can help us move toward a more optimistic interpretation of the downs we will inevitably face. So the next time you catch yourself feeling hopeless or helpless about some snag in your career, some frustration at your job, or some disappointment in your personal life, remember that there is always a third path upwards. Your only task is to find it. And above all, remember that success is not about never falling down, or even simply about falling down and getting back up over and over like I did in the Helping the Elderly experiment. Success is about more than simple resilience. It's about using that downward momentum to propel ourselves in the opposite direction. It's about capitalizing on setbacks and adversity to become even happier, even more motivated, and even more successful. It's not falling down, it's falling up. Principle number 5, the Zorro Circle. How limiting your focus to small, manageable goals can expand your sphere of power. According to legend, a masked hero named Zorro roamed what is now the southwestern United States, fighting for those who could not fight for themselves. Zorro was resolute, disciplined, and fearless, a combination that immortalized him as the popular hero of so many books, TV shows, and movies. Add to this the mix of his witty one-liners and effortless skill with women, and Zorro seemed to embody too many irresistible qualities for any one man, even one played by Antonio Banderas. But there is a lesser-known chapter to Zorro's story. According to legend, Zorro was not always that swashbuckler able to swing from chandeliers and overpower 10 men with the slash of his sword. At the beginning of the film, The Mask of Zorro, we see him as the young and impetuous Alejandro, whose passion far exceeds his patience and discipline. His quest is to assail villains and right the injustices of the world, but he desires to do so immediately and spectacularly. The higher he flies, the farther he falls, until he soon feels out of control and utterly powerless. By the time the aging swordmaster Don Diego meets him, Alejandro is a broken man, a slave to drinking and despair. But Don Diego sees the young man's potential and takes him under his wing, promising Alejandro that mastery and triumph will come with dedication and time. In the hidden cave that serves as Don Diego's lair, the elder swordmaster begins Alejandro's training by drawing a circle in the dirt. Hour after hour, Alejandro is forced to fight only within a small circle. As Don Diego wisely tells his protege, "The circle will be your world, your whole life. Until I tell you otherwise, there is nothing outside of it." Once Alejandro masters control of this small circle, Don Diego allows him to slowly attempt greater and greater feats, which, one by one, he achieves. Soon he is swinging from ropes, besting his trainer in a sword fight, even performing a set of push-ups over burning candles. Not the most practical skill to hone, but cinematically impressive nonetheless. But none of these achievements would ever have been possible had he not first learned to master that small circle. Before that moment, Alejandro had no command over his emotions, no sense of his own skill, no real faith in his abilities to accomplish a goal, and worst of all, no feeling of control over his own fate. Only after he masters that first circle does he start to become Zoro, the legend. Circle of Control. The concept of the Zoro Circle is a powerful metaphor for how we can achieve our most ambitious goals in our jobs, our careers, and our personal lives. One of the biggest drivers of success is the belief that our behavior matters, that we have control over our future. Yet when our stresses and workloads seem to mount faster than our ability to keep up, feelings of control are often the first things to go, especially when we try to tackle too much at once. If, however, we first concentrate our efforts on small, manageable goals, we regain the feeling of control so crucial to performance. By first limiting the scope of our efforts, then watching those efforts have the intended effect, we accumulate the resources, knowledge, and confidence to expand the circle, gradually conquering a larger and larger area. Don Diego didn't teach young Alejandro how to be a swashbuckling swordsman overnight. Zoro started small, then little by little, mastered his ever-widening circle. His legendary success followed from there. Tending plants and careers. The importance of control. Feeling that we are in control, that we are masters of our own fate at work and at home, is one of the strongest drivers of both well-being and performance. Among students, greater feelings of control lead not only to higher levels of happiness, but also to higher grades and more motivation to pursue the careers they really want. Similarly, employees who feel that they have high levels of control at the office are better at their jobs and report more job satisfaction. These benefits then ripple outward. A 2002 study of nearly 3,000 wage and salaried employees for the National Study of the Changing Workforce found that greater feelings of control at work predicted greater satisfaction in nearly every aspect of life, family, jobs, relationships, and so on. People who felt in control at work also had lower levels of stress, work-family conflict, and job turnover. Interestingly, psychologists have found that these kinds of gains in productivity, happiness, and health have less to do with how much control we actually have and more with how much control we think we have. Remember that how we experience the world is shaped largely by our mindset. Well, the most successful people in work and in life are those who have what psychologists call an internal locus of control, the belief that their actions have a direct effect on their outcomes. People with an external locus, on the other hand, are more likely to see daily events as dictated by external forces. It's easy to see why the former is more adaptive in work situations. If passed over for a promotion, for example, a person with an external locus of control might say, "The people here don't recognize talent. I never had a chance." And subsequently, lose motivation. After all, if we believe nothing we do matters, we fall prey to the insidious grip of learned helplessness I described in the last chapter. On the other hand, someone with an internal locus will look for what he or she might have done better, and then work to improve in that area. People with an external locus don't just duck the blame for failure, though. They also miss out on the credit for their successes, which can be equally maladaptive because it undermines both confidence and dedication. I once worked with a client who had such an external locus of control that no matter how many accolades she received, she always said that she just got lucky or that her boss had just been easy on her. She never felt that her own actions had much impact on her achievements. And as a result, she was never truly engaged or fulfilled by her work. One of the best places to understand the effect of locus of control on performance is in the world of sports. Think about how the best athletes act in those ubiquitous post-game press conferences. Do they blame their losses on the sun for getting in their eyes or the referee for making bad calls? Do they attribute wins to their horoscopes or lucky streaks? No. When they win, they graciously accept the praise they receive, and when they lose, they congratulate their opponent on a job well done, believing that, for the most part, our actions determine our fates in life, can only spur us to work harder. And when we see this hard work pay off, our belief in ourselves only grows stronger. This is true in nearly every domain of life. Research has shown that the people who believe that the power lies within their circle have higher academic achievement, greater career achievement, and are much happier at work. An internal locus lowers job stress and turnover, and leads to higher motivation, organizational commitment, and task performance. Internals, as they are sometimes called, have even stronger relationships, which makes sense given the studies show how much better they are at communicating, problem solving, and working to achieve mutual goals. They are also more attentive listeners and more adept at social interactions, all qualities, incidentally, that predict success at work as well as at home. Because feeling in control over our jobs and our lives reduces stress, it even affects our physical health. One sweeping study of 7,400 employees found that those who felt that they had little control over deadlines imposed by other people had a 50% higher risk of coronary heart disease than their counterparts. In fact, this effect was so staggering, researchers concluded that feeling a lack of control over pressure at work is as great a risk factor for heart disease as even high blood pressure. But perhaps the most eye-opening example of how powerful the perception of control is doesn't come from the business world. It actually comes from the elderly. In one incredible study, researchers found that when they gave a group of nursing home residents more control over simple tasks in their daily lives, like putting them in charge of their own houseplants, not only did their levels of happiness improve, but their mortality rate actually dropped in half. It's hard to find a circle of control smaller than caring for a houseplant. And yet, feeling mastery over even that tiny task actually extended their lives. Losing control. The dueling brain. Unfortunately, given how important it is to our success, we don't always feel in control. Some of us are inherently prone to an external locus, and the rest of us can fall into that mindset the second we feel overwhelmed by too many demands on our time, attention, and abilities. To fully understand how this happens, we need to take a closer look inside the brain. As we go about our daily lives, our actions are often determined by the brain's two dueling components. Our knee-jerk-like emotional system, let's call him the jerk, and our rational cognitive system, let's call him the thinker. The oldest part of the brain, evolutionarily speaking, is the jerk, and it is based in the limbic emotional region, where the amygdala reigns supreme. Thousands of years ago, this knee-jerk system was necessary for our survival. Back then, we didn't have time to think logically when a saber-toothed tiger jumped out of the underbrush. Instead, the jerk readily leapt into action. The amygdala sounded the alarm, flooded our body with adrenaline and stress hormones, and sparked an immediate innate reflex, a fight-or-flight response. It's thanks to the jerk, really, that we are all sitting here 10,000 years later. Today, fortunately, few saber-toothed tigers stalk our office parks. In the modern world, where life's problems are usually more complicated than flee or be eaten, the jerk's reflexive responses can sometimes do more harm than good. In particular, when it comes to decision-making, the jerk often gets us in a lot of trouble. That's why, over thousands of years of evolution, we've also developed the thinker, the rational system in the brain that resides mostly in the prefrontal cortex. This is what we use to think logically, draw conclusions from many pieces of information, and plan for the future. The thinker's purpose is simple, but it reflects a huge evolutionary leap. Think, then react. Most of our daily challenges are better served by the thinker, but unfortunately, when we're feeling stressed or out of control, the jerk tends to take over. This isn't something that happens consciously. Instead, it's biological. When we're under pressure, the body starts to build up too much cortisol, the toxic chemical associated with stress. Once the stress has reached a critical point, even the smallest setback can trigger an amygdala response, essentially hitting the brain's panic button. When that happens, the jerk overpowers the thinker's defenses, spurring us into action without conscious thought. Instead of think, then react, the jerk responds with fight or flight. We have become victims of what scientists call emotional hijacking. Over the past decade, researchers have been evaluating how this kind of emotional hijacking affects performance and decision-making at work. In one study, psychologist Richard Davidson used his expertise in neuroscience to pinpoint why certain people were particularly resilient in the face of stress, while others were so easily debilitated by it. He put both groups in identical high-stress situations, like solving difficult math problems in a short amount of time or writing about the most upsetting moments of their lives, while he simultaneously tracked their brain function using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. As each subject tackled the challenge at hand, Davidson watched both the rational and reflexive parts of the brain light up on the brain scan, dueling for supremacy. When he compared the patterns, he found that in the resilient individuals, the prefrontal cortex rapidly won over the limbic system. In other words, the thinker took over almost immediately from the jerk. The easily troubled group, on the other hand, exhibited a continuous rise in amygdala activity, which meant that the jerk had hijacked the thinker, overwhelming the brain's reasoning and coping capabilities and making the distress much worse. Hijacked at work. At this point, you might be wondering, what does all this brain activity have to do with achieving our goals at work? Quite a lot, actually. Psychologist Daniel Goleman, author of the groundbreaking book Emotional Intelligence, has extensively studied the toll this emotional hijacking can take on our professional lives. When small stresses pile up over time, as they so often do in the workplace, it only takes a minor annoyance or irritation to lose control. In other words, to let the jerk into the driver's seat. When this hijacking occurs, we might lash out at a colleague, or start to feel helpless and overwhelmed, or suddenly lose all energy and motivation. As a result, our decision-making skills, productivity, and effectiveness plummet. This can have real consequences, not just for individuals, but for entire teams and organizations. At one large company, researchers found that managers who felt the most swamped by job pressure ran teams with the worst performance and the lowest net profits. A failing economy can be a powerful trigger for emotional hijacking too. Neuroscientists have found that financial losses are actually processed in the same areas of the brain that respond to mortal danger. In other words, we react to withering profits and a sinking retirement account the same way our ancestors did to a saber-toothed tiger. Daniel Kahneman, the only psychologist to have ever won the Nobel Prize for Economics, has made enormous strides in our understanding of how the dueling brain affects decision-making in business. Before he came onto the scene, the prevailing belief was that humans are rational decision-makers, that we make financial and economic decisions based on a rational assessment of potential profits and losses. But Kahneman and his colleague Amos Tversky proved just how wrong this is. One classic experiment, known as the ultimatum game, goes like this. Researchers invite two people who do not know each other into the lab. One of them is given 10 $1 bills and told to divide the money between himself and the other subject in any way he likes. He can keep all $10 for himself. He can split it $6 and $4, etc. Then he gives the recipient an ultimatum. Take the money or leave it. Here's the catch. If the recipient chooses to leave it, both people get nothing. For traditional economists, this is fairly straightforward. A rational person will always take the deal, no matter how stingy. After all, even if it's only $1, that's still one more dollar than they came in with. But as it turns out, most recipients actually reject offers of $1 or even $2. Why? Because instead of rationally weighing their options, they allow their emotions, usually anger and annoyance at having been given a raw deal, to take over. This doesn't make rational sense, of course, because they're turning down a free $2 just to be spiteful, but it happens all the time. When neuroscientists investigate further, they find that the more active the limbic system is in the brain, the more likely the stingy offer will be rejected. As one researcher writes, "These findings suggest that when participants reject an unfair offer, it appears to be the product of a strong, seemingly negative emotional response." I've seen the jerk wreak havoc in companies all around the world. It is the reason shareholders buy high and sell low, even when they know they should do exactly the opposite. It is also the reason we fall prey to market bubbles, and the reason markets crash when those bubbles burst. As Jason Zweig points out in his book, Your Money and Your Brain, everyone knows that panic selling is a bad idea, but a company that announces it earned 23 cents per share instead of 24 cents can lose $5 billion of market value in a minute and a half. When our brain hits the panic button, reason goes out the window, and our wallets, our careers, and our bottom lines all suffer. Regaining control, one circle at a time. So how do we reclaim control from the jerk and put it back in the hands of the thinker? The answer is in the Zorro circle. The first goal we need to conquer, or circle we need to draw, is self-awareness. Experiments show that when people are primed to feel high levels of distress, the quickest to recover are those who can identify how they are feeling and put those feelings into words. Brain scans show verbal information almost immediately diminishes the power of those negative emotions, improving well-being and enhancing decision-making skills. So whether you do it by writing down feelings in a journal or talking to a trusted coworker or confidant, verbalizing the stress and helplessness you are feeling is the first step towards regaining control. Once you've mastered the self-awareness circle, your next goal should be to identify which aspects of the situation you have control over and which you don't. When I worked with the Shanghai manager and his colleagues I mentioned in the last chapter, I asked them to write out all their stresses, daily challenges, and goals, then to separate them into two categories: things that they have control over and things they don't. Anyone could do the simple exercise on a piece of paper, an Excel spreadsheet, or even a napkin over post-work martinis. The point is to tease apart the stresses that we have to let go of because they're out of our hands, while at the same time identifying the areas where our effort will have a real impact so that we can then focus our energy accordingly. Once my trainees are armed with a list of what is indeed still within their control, I have them identify one small goal they know they can quickly accomplish. By narrowing their scope of action and focusing their energy and efforts, the likelihood of success increases. Think of it this way. The best way to wash a car is to put a thumb over the hose's spout so that only a fraction of the area is open. Why? Because this concentrates the water pressure, making the hose much more powerful. At work, the equivalent of this is concentrating your efforts on small areas where you know you can make a difference. By tackling one small challenge at a time, a narrow circle that slowly expands outward, we can relearn that our actions do have a direct effect on our outcomes, that we are largely the masters of our own fates. With an increasingly internal locus of control and a greater confidence in our abilities, we can then expand our efforts outward. You can't sprint your way to a marathon. At first, some perennial high achievers have a difficult time with this concept. 3 years ago, I worked with a very busy vice president who wanted to stop running herself ragged at work and start running marathons instead. She wasn't in the best shape of her life, as she hadn't been exercising at all because of her busy workload. But she believed that if she could manage a huge team across three continents, she could manage to run 26 miles. I'm no professional runner, but I feared her outsized ambition might get her in trouble. So I offered a few words of unsolicited advice. If you haven't run a marathon before, perhaps you should start slowly by running laps around the track at the gym, then building up from there. She didn't care for that idea. Running laps, she said. You don't understand. I want to run a marathon in a month. I'll need to start long runs immediately. She bought sleek shoes, high-tech gear, and began running fiercely every morning before work. By the end of the 2 weeks, she was racked by fatigue, crippled by shin splints, and frustrated that she hadn't managed to run more than 5 miles. So she gave up, 21 miles short of her goal. Unwilling to start with small circles, she had taken on too much at once and failed, and she didn't feel good about it. Unfortunately, when it comes to our work, we are often faced with unreasonable expectations, both those we set for ourselves and those others set for us. But when our goals are unrealizable, we run the risk of ending up like that overreaching marathoner, frustrated, dejected, and stuck. In today's results-obsessed workplace, it's no wonder we're impatient and overly ambitious. We want to be the top salesman, or earn the highest bonus, or have the biggest office. And we want it now. If we hire a new CEO, we're expected to be profitable the next quarter. If we hire a new head coach, we're expected to win the very next game. Our reality TV culture, which tells us the change isn't worth making or televising, unless it's immediate and Olympian in size, doesn't help either. We are taught to believe that total makeovers of house, body, and psyche are possible all in a 30-minute episode, minus commercials. But in the real world, this all-or-nothing mindset nearly guarantees failure. Furthermore, the feelings that result from frustrated attempts and overwhelming stressors hijack our brain, jump-starting that vicious and insidious cycle of helplessness that puts our goals even further out of reach. No matter what you may have heard from motivational speakers, coaches, and the like, reaching for the stars is a recipe for failure. In part one, I talked about pushing the limits of possibility. I do believe it's important to do this, just not all at once. That's why psychologists who specialize in goal-setting theory advocate setting goals of moderate difficulty. Not so easy that we don't have to try, but not so difficult that we get discouraged and give up. When the challenges we face are particularly challenging and the payoff remains far away, setting smaller, more manageable goals helps us build our confidence and celebrate our forward progress and keeps us committed to the task at hand. As Harvard Business School professor Peter Bregman advises, don't write a book, write a page. Don't expect to be a great manager in your first 6 months. Just try to set expectations well. No matter how small the initial circle is, it can lead to big returns. In the Talent Code, Daniel Coyle discusses how the strategy of finding and improving small problems has helped businesses flourish. The practice, often referred to as Kaizen, which is Japanese for continuous improvement, involves a focus on tiny, incremental changes, improving efficiency on a production line, for instance, by shifting a trash bin 1 foot to the left. As Coyle points out, each tiny fix can add up to over 1 million tiny fixes each year. With Kaizen, in other words, companies can use the Zorro Circle to transform incremental change into mammoth results. Putting it all together. I once worked with a head copywriter of an advertising firm who found it difficult not to worry about the financial health of her company. How many clients, account services was landing? What kind of designs the art department was producing? Whether or not her boss would start laying people off. Once she realized that each of these things was well outside her control and that worrying about them only led to heightened levels of stress, she was able to shift her focus towards fixing what was troubling her in her job, her workplace, and in many ways, her life. As with other clients, I had her make two lists, what she could control and what she couldn't. As often happens, she was surprised, I might say shocked, to see how much of her daily life fell into the former column. She managed a team of 8 people, all talented copywriters who looked to her for instruction and guidance. She was in charge of leading the creative meetings that brainstormed ideas for each client. She may not have been a top executive, but every word the firm placed on a client's advertisement was in her hands. So for her first Zorro Circle, we set the following goal: to improve only the copy that she herself wrote. Recommitting herself to this manageable goal not only helped her focus her energies on something she could handle, the best part was that once her own performance improved, her circle of influence really did expand. The better her writing got, the harder her team worked to follow her example, and the team's improved performance soon raised the bar higher for other departments, which responded with renewed enthusiasm and creativity. Ironically, by recognizing that she had no control over the art department's designs, she indirectly influenced their designs after all. This gave her the confidence she needed to set her sights even higher. And pretty soon, her leadership was a great contributor to the company's overall performance. Pizza boxes and inboxes. We often feel the most stress or the most emotionally hijacked when we stare into the void of our jam-packed to-do list, inbox, or desktop. One look at the towering pile of papers looming on our desk or the 300 unread emails, and our feelings of control fly right out the window. As a freshman proctor, I advised more than my fair share of disorganized students, who ranged from the typically untidy to the pathologically messy. During my second year on the job, the fire department reported one of my students, a tennis player named Joey, because his room was so full of old pizza boxes, empty bottles, scattered newspapers, and falling towers of textbooks, that it couldn't pass a fire code inspection. Not only was his room an incinerator waiting to happen, the fire inspector feared Joey might have trouble escaping his own room in the case of an emergency, not to mention in the case of class. Some messes can be appreciated as organized chaos, but Joey's disorder had crossed over from quirky to debilitating. On the one hand, he wanted to get his life in order. On the other, the idea of tackling this massive disaster felt completely overwhelming. So we drew a Zorro circle, literally. I found a small patch of desk that had one stack of papers on it, and we traced a circle only a foot in diameter around it. "Let's clear it off," I told Joey, "and put each paper in its rightful place." Then instead of moving on to the rest of the desk right away, I told him to spend the next day defending the newly clean patch against any threats to order. Given Joey's usual habits, even that was a difficult task. He admitted as much the next day, but it was manageable. And once he had done it, he seemed genuinely pleased. So the next day, we chose another corner of his desk and applied the same rule. With each subsequent day came one more clutter-free circle, not to mention a greater sense of control and a strengthened commitment to the project. A mere 2 weeks later, the room was a spotless shadow of its former self. By establishing small circles of success and gradually expanding outward, Joey mastered the larger circle of his life. He was happy, and so was the fire department. A cluttered desk is fundamentally no different from a cluttered inbox, a problem that haunts too many modern workers. In both instances, the things of our lives have gained control over the functionality of our lives, and productivity suffers as a result. I had just given a talk to the employees of a large manufacturing company when one of the senior executives, Barry, invited me into his office. We weren't even inside the door when he began apologizing for the clutter. His office looked like a 4-year-old had been playing paper tornado. But Barry had an even bigger problem on his mind: his email. He confessed that his inbox contained over 1,400 messages, which had piled up over the last 2 months while he worked on an all-consuming project. Now that the project was over, he knew he had to start addressing the pileup, but the mere thought of it seemed to strike fear into his heart. I studied the problem over his shoulder as he scrolled through all his unread messages. 3 minutes later, he was barely through a quarter of them. "I'll never dig out from under this mountain," he said. "I might as well contract a computer virus that just destroys my whole computer." His stress level was so high at this point that every new email sent his body into a reflexive stress response. Just thinking about it made him feel nauseous. Not only did he want to avoid dealing with his email, he was so overwhelmed by the situation, he didn't feel like doing any work at all. I agreed to help. First, I told him he needed to quell his growing anxiety. This inbox was not a saber-toothed tiger. It was a problem to be solved by planning and deliberate effort, not adrenaline-fueled panic. I could see he needed to talk about the problem, to put his feelings into words in order to move the challenge from the emotional part of his brain to the problem-solving part. I reminded him that self-awareness was a swift antidote for emotional hijacking and recommended that he keep a notebook nearby to jot down his thoughts whenever the stress seemed to be rising to the surface. Then we drew the next circle. Dealing with 2 months' worth of unread emails was more than anyone could handle all at once, and Barry needed to see some progress right away. So I told him to forget everything that had been written before today and to respond only to each new email as it came in. After 3 or 4 days of tackling only new emails, once he started to feel in command of the situation, he could go back through the emails of the day before and address those. And so he could proceed, tacking on one extra day at a time, until he slowly worked his way back to the beginning. I also told him he couldn't spend more than an hour each day on this task. Without a time limit, even small incremental tasks can quickly escalate back into an overwhelming challenge with no end in sight. 3 weeks later, I received an email from Barry. He proudly told me that if I responded immediately, I would be one of only 5 emails currently in his inbox. I was amazed. Furthermore, he had attached a picture of his spotless office, almost unrecognizable from the paper tornado I had first encountered. I wrote back that, assuming he hadn't subbed in a photo from an Office Depot ad, congratulations were in order. He had started with small, manageable steps forward, and now he was celebrating a giant success. Zorro goes to Gotham. As a native of the Southwest, Zorro never got to fight crime in New York City. But in a way, the same lessons that made Zorro a hero have helped make New York a safer city. In his book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell recounts how city officials battled a rising crime rate in the 1980s and 90s. It was an overwhelming problem that no one quite knew how to fix. No matter how much money the city spent, no matter what the police did, they just couldn't seem to curb the dangerous trend. Finally, a small group of officials surprised everyone by adopting a radical new strategy, based on the now famous broken windows theory. First devised in 1982 by sociologists James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, the theory explains how small acts of vandalism can quickly balloon into widespread crime. As the theory has it, one broken window in an abandoned building will soon multiply into many broken windows, which will lead to graffiti, then muggings, then car thefts, and so on. So the city officials decided to see whether this also worked in reverse. They started with the subway, immediately redirecting all their money and attention towards fixing the windows and cleaning up the graffiti, literally one car at a time. Understandably, city denizens were quite skeptical at first. As Gladwell explains, many subway advocates at the time told them not to worry about graffiti, to focus on the larger questions of crime and subway reliability. And it seemed like reasonable advice. Worrying about graffiti at a time when the entire system was close to collapse, seems as pointless as scrubbing the decks of the Titanic as it headed toward the icebergs. But despite